This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.
It's Thursday, the 19th of June. I'm Stuart Lerman. I may or may not do it. Those are the words of US President Donald Trump on Iran. But what does this involvement look like? Our partners at Bloomberg report.
This is a decision that is likely to be the largest foreign policy decision of President Trump's second term. That's my guess if he decides to go forward. And at this point, a decision not to go forward with military force also carries consequences. So I think they're considering a few things. First, I think they're assessing, is there a prospect for a diplomatic outcome here, as Michael just said. I think the probability of that is quite low, but it needs to be probed quite seriously because this is still the preferred option if the Iranians will agree to the kind of deal, which is now much more onerous than the kind of deal that might have been negotiated a few weeks ago. So is there any scope that this, you know, the 1 minute to midnight moment could result in a deal, I think is obviously something that needs to be assessed and would be discussed. Presuming that their assessment is the Iranians are not prepared to go there, that there's a take it or leave it deal somewhere on the table and the Iranians say no, the question of military force is not just a yes or no question. If the U.S. does decide to use force to basically disable Fordo, which is the largest facility that still has advanced centrifuges that's deep in the mountains that the Israelis are not able to take care of on their own, that's not the only question. The U.S. has to think about, should it just attack Fordo, or should it also attack facilities that the Iranians are likely to use in terms of retaliating against a U.S. strike? Because the Israelis have really degraded a lot of Iranian military capability, but it's not necessarily the same capability that might be used to, say, attack U.S. bases. Then there's the whole question of how is the U.S. prepared in the region to protect its assets and its people?
Well, it's interesting when you put all of this together, knowing as well another carrier strike group is on its way, Megan, the USS Gerry Ford now steaming toward the region here. We know how many assets we've surged into that area, though the B-2 bombers were moved back to Whiteman Air Force Base, and I realize they can fly around the world with air-to-air refueling. But it makes you wonder what exactly our posture is now. We heard from the ambassador, Mike Huckabee, on X, urgent notice, American citizens wanting to leave Israel. He writes, the embassy in Israel is working on evacuation flights and cruise ship departures. This crouched position can be kept for how long?
I would say that this position certainly does. It's not hours, it's days that this could be done. I think there's still the scope to explore, you know, what needs to be done in the coming hours and maybe the next day or two, but probably not much longer than that. One question that I think hasn't been discussed thus far in the program, but is also relevant, is what is the Israeli capacity for continuing to protect itself against any incoming ballistic missiles from the Iranians? If that capacity is dwindling, then that might add a certain urgency. But otherwise, we're not seeing a situation where Iran is going to be able to get a nuclear bomb in a matter of days or a week. It certainly, you know, still has the ability to do escalatory things, but it isn't something that if we don't see it tonight, it doesn't mean we won't see it tomorrow or the next day or even the day after.
Yeah. A day is a long time in politics, and this development is no exception. Back home, after months of silence, Robin Kabanek spoke to my colleague Alec Hogg about his abrupt departure as John Steenhuisen's chief of staff. Let's take a look.
So I think it's important for, just to start, that I never was a DA member. I never voted. I voted for the DA once when I was 18. I was never part of the structures of the DA. I was never paid by the DA for anything. I had a friendly relationship with some people in the DA. Some in leadership and some at a more local level. So
Why were you never a DA member?
I was never invited, to be honest, and I never thought of joining the DA.
Yeah, you never get invited to a political party, but
sure.
But it's quite important because you now go and hitch your trailer, as it were, to the leader of the DA. So in the back of your mind, you must have been thinking, hang on, if I get close to Steenhuisen, and if I do go into this, I've now had the great gateway drug into politics, if I get involved there, maybe this will be a fast track into really making changes in South Africa. Did that occur to you in your thinking?
Well, I mean, when he asked me to join, and I was headhunted, I didn't apply or anything like that. Like, he asked me to join out of the blue, I might add, really out of the blue. And for that, I'll always be grateful. Like, to be asked to be a chief of staff to a minister, especially the leader of a political party, is a great honor. And it's something that I'll always cherish. But I was there to serve the minister. He happened to be the DA leader, but I was there to serve the minister. My job is to serve the minister and the ministry, and then coordinate the ministry along with everyone in the sector, including the department and other ministries. And that was my job, and that's what I did. I had no intentions of joining the DA. I had no intentions of trying to change the DA. My job was, I was very busy doing my job. So I'm quite good at what the term, compartmentalizing what the job is and what the role is. And I have no intention of so-called playing politics as the chief of staff to the Minister of Agriculture. I'm there to do a job. Agriculture is vitally important. It could soak up so much more labor. We could open up so much more market access around the world. We can really get down and ensure that biosecurity and that the health of animals are perfectly fine, so we can have much more market access, which brings far more forex back into South Africa, invest far more into agriculture, get so many more jobs. It's about the important industry that has been neglected for a very long time. And my role was, and my goal was, along with the minister, of course, is just to make sure that industry can thrive. And that's it.
A huge potential, huge, huge potential for South African agriculture. You saw that, and this was your way of serving. It's interesting when one goes into the public service. I've worked in the public service for 2.5, 3 years at the SABC. And it's like your mindset changes. You really are there to serve. And I found a lot of the people I worked with were incredibly dedicated. And subsequent to that, seeing people working in the public sector, they get a bad rap often in the media, but a lot of people are there, seriously are there to serve. Did you find that as well?
I had a very good relationship with the department and the staff members of the department. I spoke to the director general fairly often. I spoke to the deputy director generals fairly often. You could see if some have sort of a political slant to what they wish to do, but they were always open to conversing about it. They were always open to talking about it. I only had professionalism and courtesy from the civil servants in the department, and it really, I actually do miss them. We used to spend quite a bit of time together with a few of them during my time there. And, you know, I think that most of them do a good job. Most of them are thoroughly decent people. Maybe one or a few bad apples, as in any other organization, but I wouldn't call these people malevolent in any way whatsoever.
Because there is a perception that the ANC has stuffed the public service with cadres, and that these are all people there just to try and do deals and steal, and they're all corrupt. I mean, that is just the way that it does when you get so much media coverage of it. It's hard to find the balance. Now that you've come out of there and had the experience that you've had, what would your perception of the public sector be, or perception rather, of that that kind of narrative?
So it is, my perception will be narrow. So I've only dealt with the Department of Agriculture. I dealt a bit with Durco in terms of organizing overseas trips and spending time with them on agendas. I did spend time with a few other people in other ministries for a very limited time, though. And I just found professional people for the most part. I'm not going to say the most efficient, go for it type of people around, but if you speak to them, they understood what they had to do. They had the knowledge, they had the expertise. I wouldn't classify these people as cadres at all. These are professional people who are doing their jobs. I have a problem with the sort of bureaucracy of the state, which is something that is not inherent to South Africa. But really, Dominic Cummings, the former advisor to Boris Johnson, once said, the essence of the state is process is more important than goal. And that's what I found a lot, which is a bit frustrating as someone in the private sector where goal is the most important thing. Whereas in the bureaucracy of the state, process is very important, often much more than the goal. So I found those sort of things frustrating, but I didn't find the people frustrating at all.
Well, but you gave it a good shot. You were running at these at a rate of knots. And then let's get back to the story. You come back from China, and suddenly you haven't got a job anymore, or they don't want you in the job anymore. Your boss doesn't want you in the job anymore. So what actually happened there?
So we were in China. My relationship with the minister was developing. We were doing very well. We arrived back on a Saturday, I believe. And during the time that we were away for about 10 days, including travel. I just felt like the media onslaught. Come on. I've seen a lot of silly things in the past. You make content, you make videos every day. You have got tens of thousands of hours of video and audio things out there. Of course, you're going to missay something, or something's going to be taken out of context. And the media really focused on like three tweets that, even to this day, I don't know what the problem with them really is. So I could feel this pressure even while in China for my duties. And on the way back, everything was perfectly fine. I said goodbye to the minister on Saturday. We arrived then. And then on the Monday, I received an email from him at about 11 a.m., which didn't say resign. No one ever formally asked me to resign. But he did say, let's try find a dignified way for you to exit. And to this day, I still actually don't know why he made that decision. He did say, like, this media is distracting from the work that we're going to do and things like that. But there was never, ever a definitive explanation for that. I have my theories about it, which I'm hoping to test quite soon. So that was the Monday, the 9th of September. And then we spoke on the phone a bit later. I could see that it felt like he was under duress for that time. And I said, well, let's meet and let's negotiate a way out, or let's see what we can do. But then he went to the Cape Town Press Club 24 hours later or 48 hours later and told the rest of the country that he asked me to resign, which I thought was a little bit sad in a way, because we haven't had a proper conversation. And that was the last time he actually spoke to me. So I haven't seen him or spoken to him since, despite my best intentions. So I still don't actually know what the reasons are, and they've never been offered to me in a real way.
You can watch that full interview on BizNews TV on YouTube. Now, the Democratic Alliance has fired a salvo at Education Minister Nkabani for misleading Parliament. Let's have a peek.
Even though the minister has revealed at least five names of the people that she claims served in her committee, you would have noted that in the letter that she sent us, there's one person that is concealed. There's one name whom we do not know who that person is. And simply the reason the minister states that that person is uncomfortable with them being known is ludicrous in my understanding, particularly because we've maintained the point, Chairperson, that it is not up to the minister and whoever her Casper the Ghost is to decide whether or not they're going to comply with the requests of Parliament or not. It is up to Parliament to dictate those terms. And therefore, although you said that we don't have to go through a summons process, I want to move and urge the committee to consider the following action steps, Chair. The first one, Chair, should be that the people that have been revealed, whose identities have been revealed, all of them must come before this House, this Parliament, to furnish us with a full detail of the minutes of the meetings that they held as far as the selection and evaluation process was concerned, fully so. And equally, we'd also like to have, in addition, the report subsequently that was compiled and sent to the NSA for the final consideration of the appointment of those names. The people I'm referring to, Chairperson, are Advocate Terumutau. Advocate Terumutau, who the minister communicated was the chairperson of this panel, however, says that never sat in any meeting. Particularly, the reason why this is a point of interest is because you would know that Advocate Mutau currently has a 2 million rand tender with the city of Johannesburg that comes directly from MMC Loyiso Masuku's department, because MMC Masuku is currently the MMC for cooperative services within the city of Johannesburg. The reason why that is a point of consideration for us and an interest is because the same Loyiso Masuku was appointed as the Food Bev board chairperson. So we want to know exactly what that relationship is, if it exists, one. Two, the second person we're referring to is Asisi Posolani. Asisi Posolani is a former SASCO member, a leader, a former ANC Youth League in the Western Cape leader who currently serves as the advisor to the minister in her office. Number three, we want Nelisiwe Simane, who's currently the chief of staff of the minister, to also appear before parliament to give us her contribution in the panel that the minister says she sat in. We also want Mabuza Ngubane to come here, who is the chief director of CETA coordination, to come before this committee to directly account for the contribution they played. The same Mabuza Ngubane, you would recall, lied directly to my face when I asked him whether he knows anything about the process in the panel, and he unequivocally said, no, he knows nothing. So he must come and tell us whether he lied then or whether it's the minister lying about him now. The last person would be Rulani Ngwenya, chairperson, who is currently the Deputy Director General for Corporate Services in the Department of Higher Education. These are people that the minister says served in this panel, in addition to the concealed other name. I call him Casper the Ghost, because the minister still does not want to give us. Those people must come and account accordingly. But equally, I want to refer, Chairperson, to the criminality of lying to Parliament. Equally, we've cited this as a committee before in the past, that it is a criminal offence for anybody to lie to Parliament. And equally, I would like to move, Chairperson, that you as the Chairperson of this committee must consider to go lay criminal charges on behalf of this committee for people who lied before this committee. The evidence is there.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
President Ramaphosa's taxpayer-funded national dialogue has come under fire. Critics say the 700 million rand initiative reflects everything but the renewal it promises. My colleague Kerry Lanahan reports.
Ramaphosa's 700 million rand national dialogue faces backlash over elitism and exclusion. By Kerry Lanahan. The ambitious national dialogue initiative, spearheaded by President Cyril Ramaphosa, is expected to cost the state more than 700 million rand, according to estimates from the dialogue's preparatory committee. Announced at a media briefing in Johannesburg on Friday, 13th of June 2025, the committee outlined a comprehensive plan that includes a national convention scheduled for the 15th of August 2025, as well as a series of public and community engagements across all 9 provinces. EWN has made a report stating that the initiative is being positioned as a nationwide effort to confront South Africa's social, economic, and political challenges through inclusive dialogue. The preparatory task team, led by figures such as Mduduzi Mbada, Oyama Mabandla, and Nkosinathi Biko, said the dialogue would involve all sectors of society, from government and labor to civil society and grassroots communities. The projected 700 million rand cost is primarily earmarked for extensive outreach efforts. According to Mbada, these costs are necessary to ensure every community is reached and heard. Democracy is not cheap. Building a nation is very costly. Just to pull the provinces and municipalities is an estimation of probably more than 700 million rand, he said. While the figure may raise eyebrows in the current economic climate, the committee insists the funds will deliver significant long-term value by laying the groundwork for a renewed national consensus. However, in a wide-ranging interview with BizNews' Chris Steyn, United Independent Movement President Neil De Beer delivered a scathing critique of the initiative, questioning both its sincerity and structure. De Beer said that he had once hoped for a meaningful, grassroots-driven process, a massive annual roadshow, taken to every province where every single differentiation of nation could be heard. Instead, he argues, the current structure excludes ordinary South Africans in favour of elite appointees, including what he described as a puzzling panel of academics, artists, and political has-beens, lacking representation from the working class, and notably omitting voices from the Afrikaner community. He also blasted the 700 million rand price tag. When I heard the cost, all I could think was Zondo, Zondo, Zondo. He said, referencing past expensive commissions that produced volumes of documents but little tangible reform. Once a gutful of your documents and your procedures, commissions and all of your meetings. This country needs leadership. It doesn't need conferences about leadership, he concluded. The National Convention in August will bring together key stakeholders to set the tone and agenda for the community engagements. These engagements, which will unfold in towns, villages, and urban centres throughout South Africa, are expected to culminate in an action plan aimed at addressing the country's most pressing issues. The final draft budget will be submitted to the government in the coming weeks, after which further planning sessions and budget workshops will be held. But as figures like Neil De Beer warn, the dialogue's success will ultimately rest on its inclusivity and credibility, and whether it can speak to the plumber, not just the professor.
You can read the extended article on BizNews Premium or watch it on BizNews TV on YouTube. Now, the lives of 1.5 billion people who use WhatsApp daily is likely to change. This, as Meta is taking the app on a bolder step into the advertising world, our partners at the Financial Times report.
Meta is introducing paid advertising on WhatsApp. It's a bit of a reversal for the tech giant. Up until this point, they've held back on adding ads to the popular messaging app. But the move is part of Meta's larger strategy to bring in new revenue and to double down on artificial intelligence. My colleague Christina Crittle covers AI for the FT, and she joins me now. Hey, Christina.
Hi, Mark.
So you just tell me about this latest change coming to WhatsApp. Am I going to start suddenly getting hit with a bunch of ads in my messages?
So Meta has decided to place the ads away from your conversation. So it's actually in WhatsApp statuses, which is a little tab that you can click on the left of the app. And it's where people can post status updates, which are very similar to stories on Instagram. I think what's really interesting about this is it's the first time that we've seen ads in WhatsApp, and it is a break from previous commitments. When I first reported that WhatsApp was exploring how to introduce ads, the head of the app basically said, "We're not doing this."
Well, that's so interesting. As far as you can tell, do we know why they did this 180?
Meta told me that it had been a long-time request from businesses that were already interacting with consumers in WhatsApp, and so they wanted to be able to reach out to consumers further in the app. And obviously for Meta, it's a great way for them to monetize as well. It's one of the last holdouts of Meta's platforms from advertising. Obviously, we have advertising on Instagram and Facebook already, so WhatsApp, which is a hugely popular communications platform, the most popular in the world, having ads in that and being able to surface ads to billions of users is going to be a huge boon for Meta, which really needs to drum up some cash.
Mm. Yeah, how is the company doing these days?
It's doing well. Its revenues beat expectations, but it's going to have to invest a huge amount of money in artificial intelligence, and it's a really competitive sector at the moment. So it needs to generate revenues elsewhere to be able to fully compete with other AI developers out there. The company has its own models, but these models have been seen to be a little bit behind some of the leading ones. So there's pressure on Meta to really prove that its models can be as good and really compete with the other ones on the market.
Yeah, tell me more about its commitment to AI. What does it look like?
So if I was talking to you a few years ago, I was probably chatting to you about the metaverse, which is when Facebook rebranded to become Meta, and it said its big focus was these virtual worlds where we were all going to interact. And that seems to have basically been downgraded for AI, and the company is investing a huge amount in AI. It seems like that's their primary focus. Every briefing I go to, it's brought up. It's said that it's going to invest $72 billion of capital expenditure into data center investments and servers. We've seen it investing huge amounts into talent as well. Some of the figures at Meta are sort of in the seven figures for a single AI hire. And very recently, we saw Meta invest $15 billion in Scale AI, which was largely to ensure that it could have its CEO, Alexander Wang, join its team.
So these are the developmental hurdles that Meta has to jump. What could trip it up?
Well, I don't even know where to start there. We have tariffs obviously impacting the industry and really being able to get your hands on hardware and some of those chips that underlie a lot of these AI models. And you have regulatory hurdles potentially to pass. We have the EU AI Act in Europe, which is coming into force. and potential regulation elsewhere around the world as well. So as Meta begins to deploy these products in front of consumers, it needs to make sure that it's compliant with local regulations, and it's not necessarily clear what those regulations are going to be.
Christina Criddle is the FT's tech correspondent. Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.
One can argue that nothing in life is free, so the move shouldn't come as too much of a surprise to users. Now, the Proteas returned back home yesterday as Test world champions. They arrived to a hero's welcome after a 27-year wait that has felt like an eternity.
We're here today because Kagiso Rabada has worked hard with us around building grit, how to stay the long game, how to persevere, what it takes to fail, get up, hone your craft. He's got a passion, he's a humble guy, and he's taught these kids about what it takes.
My favorite player right now has to be the captain, Temba Bavuma. Considering what he's been through, you know, having to grind and come up and prove himself, and I think that's what sports is about, you know, proving your doubters and yourself, like overcoming adversity. I think, yeah, that's what sports is about, Jason.
Rabadi, Conrad, and Temba Bavuma, the best guys.
Tristan Stubbs, because I've always been a fan, but Aiden, Marco, KG, all of them. They're all just champions in our eyes.
With me being a UJ player, with Ryan Rickleton representing them back in the day, he's definitely one of my favourites.
I'll have to definitely go with Marco Jansen. Man of that length and that speed of bowling, he's got quite potential ahead of him as well.
I think KG Rabada has to be up there. I think the amount of times he saved South Africa and just puts everything in it, we love KG.
This is a fantastic achievement and another reflection of what South Africans can do when they work together as one. And that's it for today's show, and a big thanks to the BizNews production team. From me, Stuart Lohman, until next time.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking.